Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my comrade and co-robot host of the evening, Mr. Spencer Williams.
Hey, what's up?
And speaking of monotone robotic voices, we got with us intern Amy.
Beep, boop, bop, beep.
I mean, you are IGNU robots. So.
But that's not saying that I'm a robot. I'm making the claim that others are robots, and I am not.
Well, when we're all robots, no one is. We have a great show.
I don't like how that quote is just applied to across our society.
It is. We got a great show in store, as we're going to be talking about the recently dropped DreamWorks picture, the latest tier fest for people to go see at the movies, and that is The Wild Robot. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do that, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune into brand new episodes each and every week. On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.podcast.com. Also, connect with us on social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
And thread something, something.
Blue perhaps. Sky, something, something.
It's always something with you, Spencer. Okay. That's right. Check us out over at filmlosophers.podcast.com, where we allegedly have everything over, allegedly 300 episodes. And we got everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.podcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Blair FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers and give us a follow or subscribe. Listen in, tell us what you think, and if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review because we've earned it.
We have.
Really happy.
That is very true. Also, we'll give you the social links at the end of the episode, but yeah, you could check us out all over there. This is going to be an interesting episode because I think this is probably one of the first animated feature of the year to actually bring the emotions out, because I don't know if there's been another one.
Inside Out 2?
Was that this year?
Was this year.
That's literally what it's about.
Well, I mean, to some extent, but we'll dive
what do you
into
mean, some extent.
Whoa. I mean,
it's the basis of the movie.
I mean, it didn't make me cry, but it was.
What?
It was. Well, I.
So you know, now who's the robot?
Oh, still not me.
Before we dive into that, let's go ahead and I wanted to talk about something that was actually pretty common knowledge right now amongst many people who are in the circles of like reviews and whatnot. And that is the Joker 2, because I'm not going to do the folly you do every time. So
you don't like French?
I like French fries.
Those aren't French.
The Joker 2 controversy that's going on. And if you've been, if you haven't heard, the opening weekend for the Joker sequel film did not do so hot. In fact, I believe I have the numbers here somewhere.
The movie we're about to review actually beat it on its opening weekend. And Megalopolis too.
Yeah.
Megalopolis did better. Oh no.
I think Megalopolis, did Megalopolis do better than Joker number dose?
I can't imagine opening weekend where people wouldn't know that. Probably.
Mm. Well, I know the movie that Wild Robot did better than Joker 2 and Megalopolis.
Yes,
I think that. The second weekend it ended up getting second place to
So Joker 2 got 96 mil for opening weekend. Which is dwarfed by its first film. It's opening weekend for the first film, but it's insane to state, and mind you, this is the second weekend that this film has been out. This weekend, Terrifier 3, a B horror B-movie horror film like has dropped in theaters for some odd reason. It's gotten monumental success enough to get a release in theaters. That movie is actually in line to do more in its opening weekend than the Joker sequel.
I mean, doesn't Terrifier have Art the Clown with his nice glasses and his weird smile? Like, is that his name? I don't
know. His name is Art the Clown, yes.
That's a nice name, though.
But part of this whole thing, like, so as much as you have a lot of people who are either trying to push against the grain or be the outlier, you know, individual who's like, oh, the movie was good, people just don't get it, or this and that. Like, no, a lot of people didn't like the film. And a lot of people stated that they didn't like the movie. There was no ands, ifs, or buts. There was people who just did not like it. For many a reasons, obviously. We didn't actually get a chance to check out the film.
We didn't get a chance. It's
actively chose not to.
Spencer and I are in agreement. I still haven't seen the first one. I have no desire to. I'm not going to see the second one. Mm-mm.
Well, okay, we didn't see it. Okay, period. There we go. We didn't watch the film. We chose not to. But there's, and mind you, we're not here to bash anyone who has an opinion as to whether or not they like the film. We are just reporting on the nature of the response leveled by this film with critics and audiences alike. If you look at the Rotten Tomato score right now, currently, it is sitting at a 33% Rotten Tomato score and a 32% on the audience score.
That's unusual.
Which tells me one thing. The audience in this particular factor just didn't like it at all. And we have that small 2-3% on the critic side that are trying to push their like artsy kind of like, oh, you didn't get it. There was a bigger picture to it. You had to take a step back and take two steps to the right and then drop off a cliff to really understand it. Like it doesn't make any sense why people would want to defend something that maybe they didn't think was actually good and they're just trying to find something. There's also, and this is true in a lot of circles within critics, there are people who have a vested interest in maintaining positive relationships with certain studios. And so they will shill out good reviews to maintain those positive relationships and continue to get access and, you know, availability to certain events and things. So whether if that's the case or I don't know, because like if you have in the critic circle, 33% of them, there's only 33% of the people who saw this that actually wanted to give it a good rating. That's saying something.
Right.
Because if the most of us, I'm not going to lie, I've shilled. I have no problem saying it. I've shilled. I've made good reviews for films that I thought were whatever, but for the sake of like, well, you know what? A positive effort here brings out positive returns. Like, shoot, I did it. And I'm pretty sure that's the case here, but to have only 33%, that's scary. And I actually kind of wanted to see what some of them were saying now that I'm here.
Now that you're there, you're like, let's review. I think the biggest thing that I'm struggling with for like in relation to this movie is, again, I'm not here to yuck anybody's yum. I don't know how this is supposed to line up in canon. I really, really don't personally care in relation to that for comic books. The thing is that you have people who, much like anybody that has a fandom that's attached to it, suddenly if it goes down the toilet, you're like, well, you didn't like it because you didn't get it. Like, I understand, and I think this has been one of the biggest complaints that you and Eddie have had, but especially you, Spencer, is that if you have to read and or watch and or do a whole bunch of homework before you show up to watch a movie that is supposed to be fairly self-explanatory, and then you're like, I didn't get it. And somebody else is like, well, of course you didn't get it because you haven't done the research. Like, no. And that's what a lot of people have been coming off like out of the woodwork and be like, listen, I saw it and I get it. And it's like, this is not one of those 3D cross your eyes prison pictures from the 90s that we all used to do, because those were amazing.
Those were fun.
I feel like this encapsulates everything that people probably are feeling right now from comingsoon.net. critic Jonathan Sim said, Joker, Folie à Deux, is the rare movie that genuinely feels like it was made for nobody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So going back to the conversation, so the controversy at hand is that initially, when this movie dropped and it was already getting bad press, Todd Phillips had, so the studio immediately, Warner Brothers, during its opening weekend, immediately came out with a press release, or at least a statement saying, we gave Todd Phillips the final say on this. The what you see on the screen is what Todd Phillips wanted to put out there. We gave him full control of it. This is what was made.
Oops.
And then another statement was made that Todd Phillips and Warner Brothers both made this film. So let me take a step back. Then James Gunn came out and said, pretty much probably at the push of Warner Brothers, yeah, this movie's not DC canon, so don't worry about this. Whereas before, James Gunn had came out and said that this was an Elseworld type of scenario, mm-hmm. which is just like another alternate universe for right. The storyline.
I mean, isn't that what the first one was anyway?
See, that's the thing. That's
because you know, that was part of the contention, if I remember. Because
it's just over there.
Well, and they're like, it's over there. But they were also going, well, we're drawing from Brian Azzarello's, the Joker's, his Joker storyline. So yeah. You need to understand it's darker and it's grittier. And I'm like, so you're trying to push yourself into canon. Is that what I'm getting?
They were trying to create as close of a narrative that mirrored canon as much as they could. Because it's really weird. And then again, James Gunn came out and was like, this is not part of our universe at all. This isn't anything that we, you know, whatever. And then here's the latest kicker. And then there was a statement that came out from Todd Phillips and Warner Brothers, who said that this movie was all Joaquin Phoenix's idea.
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, yes. You didn't hear about the dream sequence?
Excuse me? Yeah.
That they both pushed every aspect of this film forward because this was something that Joaquin Phoenix had envisioned to come about.
Like he had a literal dream.
Nobody can see my mouth agape, but my mouth is legitimately agape. And
Joaquin didn't see that bus that really came by and ran him over.
Not only ran him over, it's a lot. What?
Yeah.
Wait, do we have a response from Joaquin Phoenix yet?
I don't think there's one.
No. Why would you? Huh?
Yeah, it doesn't really make any sense because for a brief period, I was wondering, I wonder if this is somehow like, what was that movie called? Whatever the last Matrix movie was.
The Resurrections.
Yeah, where they just, where it felt like they were just trying to burn it down to never have it come back. Because at first I was like, is this that? Because a musical seems like a good way to like annoy a crowd that's not expecting that.
But also if you're going to actually like enjoy it and execute fully as a musical. But again, I have no desire to see this. Like I have to say the gonads on the particular people that are like, listen, we have the money. We make the final say. We are the final call. Oh, it wasn't us. It was that guy over there. Like, this is not a Francis Ford Coppola thing. Because let's be honest, if it was Joaquin Phoenix, they would have been like, we had really good success. We'd like to see something like that, but we're going to have to ask you to like pony up some money. We're not seeing that. Like, and then, what was it? I saw randomly a reel that it was when it was at the Venice or was it? Which film festival?
Oh, at the Venice Film Festival or Cannes.
It was one of the film festivals. One of them. But they stood up and people were clapping and ovation.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and he walks over to Lady Gaga and he's like, no, it's terrible. It was terrible. You shouldn't be clapping. And her face like falls. They had somebody that reads lips that was like translating it. And I was like, oh, he knows. He knows it's terrible.
And mind you, this is barely the second weekend it's been out and still news is still pouring out about it. But we haven't had a response yet from, not that I know of, I couldn't find one from Joaquin Phoenix. And honestly, the biggest issue that a lot of people have with this movie are the minimal Batman fans who feel like they're catching like little glimpses of their childhood, you know, villains that they wanted to see, you know, being fully fleshed by, you know, Joaquin Phoenix in a Batman film. And unfortunately, that's not what they're getting, especially with the way this film wraps up. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, but I'm not going to give it away, but it does end in a way where it erases any possibility of people's hope that Joaquin Phoenix will continue on as the Joker. You know, and it's crazy that
still better than a particular Joker. Jared Leto.
What? Okay.
Yeah. He's still a better Joker than Jared Leto. Like, let's just put that out there.
Yeah, sure. I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
Well, I agree with that.
Like, okay. I mean, whatever.
this has gone off the rails.
Either way.
Much like Jared Leto.
Exactly. And this movie. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm curious to see how the rest of the fallout's going to take for this film. I'm not too sure how he's going to respond, as in referring to Joaquin Phoenix, or if it's going to have an effect on his career, but who knows? We can effectively say Todd Phillips is probably not going to do anything with Warner Brothers for a while. So yeah, I guess we'll just wait and see how the rest of the chips fall.
I'm not going to pick up those chips.
I don't think anybody wants to pick up those chips.
They're cow chips at this point.
Well, and
Spencer just gets a head shake.
Don't take me back to elementary school. Oh my Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Yes. Speaking of wild, that does bring us to our conversation of the evening, and that is our review of the latest book to film adaptation done by DreamWorks, and that is The Wild Robot. This movie has pretty much been one of the most anticipated films of the year, as due to the acclaim that the book series has had and the recognition to it as well. So we all got a chance to check out this film, and we are excited to talk about it. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
The epic adventure follows the journey of a robot, Rosm Unit 7134, Roz for short, that is shipwrecked on an uninhabited island and must learn to adapt to the harsh surroundings, gradually building relationships with the animals on the island and becoming the adoptive parent of an orphaned gosling.
Written for the screen and directed by Chris Sanders, and based on the 2016 novel of the same name by Peter Brown, the film stars the vocal talents of Lupita Nyong'o, Pedro Pascal, Kit Connor, Bill Nighy, Stephanie Hsu, Mark Hamill, Catherine O'Hara, Matt Berry, and Ving Rhames. A couple key pieces about the film. With a 98% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, this movie is actually tied with 2010's How to Train Your Dragon, which was also written and directed by Chris Sanders, as the highest rated DreamWorks animation film.
Sorry, Shrek.
Yeah, that says a lot. I mean, if you're looking at a film that has surpassed, like that first How to Train Your Dragon movie was like
phenomenal.
It
still is.
Ooh. And so this being it having to surpass that film, that says a lot. Another key piece of information, according to author Peter Brown, the inspiration for The Wild Robot came from a sketch he did of a robot in a tree. He then asked the question, what would an intelligent robot do in the wilderness? And in terms of along those lines of inspiration, the robot's name is Rosm, shortened to Roz. Brown had written that this is a nod to the 1920s science fiction stage play Rosm's Universal Robots, written by Czech writer Karel Kopek. Kopek and his brother Joseph Kopek introduced the word robot into the English language and into science fiction. The word is drawn from the Slavic root robot, meaning labor. The play was also the first use of the word to denote a mechanical humanoid. So this story carries a lot of like legacy and lineage in the actual, not just in storytelling, but even in just science fiction, or even science in general. I mean, the idea of humanoid robots, humanoid machinations. Things like that all stemmed from this stage play where he drew inspiration for this. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then obviously we have to mention the elephant in the room on this one. The main processor the robots use is designated Alpha-113, a reference to the room A113 at the California Institute of the Arts used by graphic design and character animation students. So there, I mean, the good thing is that this still carries on that whole trope, not trope, but a tradition, if you will.
Tradition, yeah.
Not so much as it being, the great thing about this is it doesn't just make that whole trademark a Disney thing. The fact that there are people from DreamWorks and, you know, from other animation studios who carry that, you know, memory and that, you know, thing in their hearts. So they put it in this one as well. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
We are going to talk about this film. And just so you know, there will be slight spoilers. So you have been warned. Spoiler alert. You heard that one, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. yeah, you've been warned. Let's talk expectations. Now, obviously, I don't think anyone else here read the book for this one.
No, I have no
children. Didn't. Yeah. Well, no, I didn't. You don't have to have children to read this book, Spencer. Reading is for everybody.
I thought this was a picture book.
Listen, no. Trump. Everybody can read Chihuahua.
I just said it was a picture book, so? I thought.
No. And your point? Yikes. I still find myself reading The Very Hungry Caterpillar every now and then. Shoot.
We're all very hungry at the end of the day.
No, so obviously, so I read the book. And so I kind of have a different set of expectations. But I want to know what your guys' expectations were coming into this based on, obviously, the marketing and what you knew about the story. So let's start with Spencer.
I didn't know anything. It's a robot. It's in the woods.
Did you not see any of the trailers?
Yeah, that's what I saw. A robot in the woods.
That's it?
Yeah.
You didn't, nothing about geese, nothing about, you know, fires, nothing about anything else going
robot
on?
Robot in the woods.
There you go.
There's going to be fires. There's a robot in the woods. There's going to be geese out in those woods. Well, there's a robot in that woods.
I you know, I take ownership of this because this was my, I asked the
what
wrong
did
question.
You get for a Trump. There you go. How dare you?
All right, we'll leave the book burner alone. All right. Abe, what were your expectations?
So first off, just seeing the trailers, I was crying. I was like, I'm going to cry. I don't care what this movie's about. I'm going to see it. And I'm going to cry. And then finding out that it was Chris Sanders that was directing, I immediately went, uh-oh, this is a great problem to have. Because I'm very aware of Chris Sanders' work. And so I was really excited. Mm. And I knew there'd be death.
Okay.
Wow. For those who don't know, why don't you clue everyone else in, since you're gatekeeping information again?
So it's a space to talk. So Chris Sanders, of course, we mentioned, did How to Train Your Dragon. He did work for quite a bit of time over at the House of Mouse. And he's actually the director and the writer for Lilo and Stitch, as well as the voice of Stitch, which, of course, as we remember, Fudge controls the weather and, you know, murdered Lilo and Nani's mom and dad.
Oh, I thought you were going to say he was like one of the recent designers of like all the Disney mains having their moms killed.
No.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
It's been around for a long time. But no. Yeah, it's the whole thing for Lilo and Stitch. And then the history and almost the cult following that comes with Lilo and Stitch. But I was really excited. Also, you know, there's technically dead mom too in How to Train Your Dragon. So death.
It's unescapable.
It's true. So my expectations kind of waver a little bit because I did read the book before going into the theater, and I have to say, like, before going into the theaters, reading the book, I was like, how are they going to do this? This is really okay. This part's really, oh my God, there's a shotgun. How are they going to do this? Like, there are parts in the book that I'm like, you can't do that. This is not Watership Down. You can't do that.
Oh, that's not a...
That was no.
Can you give an example of like something that's in the book where you're like, they're not putting that on the screen?
There was a shotgun, he said, so that's a start.
Yeah, like...
Was the robot an attack robot originally? Or?
So well, okay, tell you what, we'll talk about it. We'll delve into it. Because I do want to go into first impressions right outside the gate as soon as the film was over. Start with Amy.
I have too many feelings. This movie has so many themes. It somehow seemed to execute in such a sincere, earnest way without being like phony about it. And I cried a lot, Spencer.
A lot?
I had a feeling.
A lot.
That's why I was constantly asking you over the last 2 weeks.
Have you seen it yet?
No. No. And then when I did, I was just, well, like coming out of, and I can, because it's part of that first impression, coming out of the theater, I simultaneously felt like it was a good cathartic thing, but also in a space of hope and like resolution and peace. Like, I wasn't totally bogged down being like, well, that's depressing. Mm. And I wasn't in a space of like, well, that was great. It was just like perfectly weirdly even keeled and I felt lighter. So that is a very big first for me.
Spencer.
So first impressions of this movie. I have never been so annoyed with a movie to make me cry this many times during one sitting. That's unacceptable. And there should be like a Surgeon General warning on a movie like that.
I am surprised you didn't cry more. I don't know the amount you did cry, but I'm surprised you didn't cry more being the person who's in IT. Like, your connection with technology just, you know.
That wasn't it.
I don't work on robot. I wish I did. That'd be amazing.
See. Well, then, see, just... But so you cried quite a bit too as well.
Yeah, I cried at her last line too, where she's just like, "You can call me Roz," and I was like, "She's still there."
That was great. Oh my god,
that was good.
So my first impression, I was glad that they kept pretty faithful to the book, to what was relevant now. Obviously, the original story was done in 2016, so there is almost like 10 years worth of time that has passed since the original story versus the modern day telling of it. So there are certain elements that had to be updated. But yeah, like, I honestly didn't think I was going to like tear up and kind of slightly cry as much as I did in this one. Especially after reading the book, and I do have to say it's probably due to the narrator who read the book while I was listening. It was an Audible, and
this isn't a picture book. This is a chapter book.
It's a book.
It's a chapter book.
I thought it was like, you know, give your mouse a cookie or something.
It's like a 78 chapter book.
This is not what I was
told. Oh, and there's
told.
Three of them apparently in the full set.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But it's worth listening to. But the narrator that I had for my book was very like, she was very Siri first gen esque.
Oh, I don't like that.
Oh. And she was like, she did.
Now, question, was it actually Siri?
God, no, I hope not.
No, that's the question of like, I'm like, wait, did.
Well, just the delivery of like that first gen Siri came out. It's like very like, hello, how can we help you today? Like that whole rhythm of it without any kind of evolution of the robot or whatever, whatnot in the voice. Which is something we'll talk about in the film. Mm-hmm. But all in all, I have to say this is hands down probably one of the best animated films. And this is in comparison to, you know, it's up there with Inside Out 2. It's like I still haven't fully processed it yet enough to state as to whether or not which one pulls out forward a little bit more, because they both have great takeaways.
Not Transformers 1, though, apparently.
No, not in comparison to like how moved I was. Like, when you have movies, especially animated films, here's the unique thing. When you have an animated film that legit makes you think about your life choices and how you could better it by following the dorky donkey in this scene or the weird squirrel in that scene, like, that takes some, like, area of expertise. Like, if you're going to create a movie where I am legitimately emotionally connected to a goose... I am
no then, a baby possum,
or the baby possums,
or
like honestly, when you're able to do something like that, that is a level of genius that I would hope to one day achieve. Because you have story writers who are creating magic out of literal cartoon characters or you know, storybook characters. And when you have things like with Inside Out 2 and the personification of emotions, and you have things like this where it's literally a service robot dropped in the middle of an island. Like, what are you supposed to do with that? How are you supposed to, you know, do, how are you supposed to logically make it make sense to someone who's got like an ADHD brain like mine? Like, no, this should not really do what it's doing, and it's doing it, and I'm confused and crying at the same time. So,
in other words, that's a win. I will take that one every day.
So let's kind of talk about the performers in this film. Right out the gate, Lupita Nyong'o is a freaking gem. Like, this woman needs to be protected. She needs, you know, you remember how they used to say, what was his name? B.B. King had his hands insured for like over $1 million. Like, each hand was
Jackie Chan in his body.
No, but B.B. King literally had his hands insured for over $1 million because of everything he was doing. This woman needs to be put on a insurance plan and a bubble to be cared for, to make sure she sticks around as long as possible, because her vocal performance in this movie was phenomenal. I remember listening to her at the beginning and I'm like, all right, this is kind of sounding like the book. And then one of the great things that she does with this role that's different from the story, or different from the way it was read, not so much the story, because, you know, you can imagine that in your own head, however you want to proceed. But Lupita Nyong'o added such nuance to the evolution of her character's understanding of the world around her, did it so well and so strategic and so beautifully that it's like, how? Like, how was she able to make that make sense and make it all work so seamless? Like, how do you quantify at what point in time that you start transitioning a robot to going from sounding like Siri to beginning to incorporate, on a minute level, emotional intonations in the way that she does? Because you don't notice it until you're at, like, until you take a look at the end versus the beginning. And it's like, she's completely different, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is my personal thought, obviously done by the great direction of Chris Sanders and the wonderful performance done by Lupita Nyong'o. You know, we've stated several times on this show that great films usually have that great trifecta: great writing, great acting, and great directing. Like, that's literally all you need to make a almost perfect film. It doesn't matter where you're filming at, it doesn't matter on what you're filming on, it doesn't matter as to any other aspect, props, whatever. If you have a great director, great writer, and great performers, you can put out great film. And this was one of those instances where great source material, great directing, obviously, with the previous, you know, iterations of his films that we've seen, or previous works that he's done with Chris Sanders, and then Lupita Nyong'o as a phenomenal actress.
I mean, it's, I don't want to be like, it's Lupita, but everything that I've experienced of her carries a level of depth and earnesty and sincerity that just translated almost naturally in her vocal performance. Again, we have literally a robot, and the very open of it is very staccatoed, is very, this is how it goes. And then you see how she starts growing and you're watching, and it's all vocally. And you don't really, you see a little bit of it in the movement of the animation, which we can talk about. But when it comes to the brass tacks of it, the entire story is driven simply by the sound of her voice. And there's something to be said about not only the care and compassion that she has for the story itself, but for her character. There was a, if I had seen a reel or something, where she was in an interview with a young lady who was Spanish speaking, and she speaks 5 or 6 languages, I think. And so, yeah, and she does it. And the little girl was talking to her and interviewing her about the wild robot. And she asked her, you know, what's the hardest part about, like, what's the most difficult language? And Lupita just came in with, like, not only was she engaged, but she gave space for herself and compassion to the space. And so she wasn't like rapid firing her Spanish, but she was speaking Spanish in a way that was organic and natural, and was timed very gently. And in thinking about that in relation to this performance, everything that she does vocally is an extension of herself in an animated form. Mm-hmm. Like, we get to a point later in the story where I'm like, that literally looks like how she would have acted it. Like, the embodiment of Roz and the movements and even some of the articulation of her, like, her eyes. It's literally just Lupita. And I was like, this is so nice. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. I don't know.
By the way, she speaks four languages. She speaks English, Spanish, Swahili, and Luo. And she also spent time learning Xhosa for her role in Black Panther. I'm not too sure how that's pronounced. And oddly enough, so she's of African descent, but she was born in Mexico. She calls herself a Kenyan Mexican. She is, and it goes to show, like, from her earlier roles, like in 12 Years a Slave, and everything else that she's done since then, even in her work in Black Panther, like even the last Black Panther film, like she shines in anything that she's in. And in this particular role.
In Us.
Oh, and when she was in Us
Honestly, she's the type of actor that, like, where it's like, where do you do badly? Because I have not seen it yet. Or maybe I skipped over it, but she's just been a gem in, like, literally everything I've seen her in.
Yeah, and it's just, I think, I have no bad... I can't be like, whoa, she dragged something down.
No. I forgot she was in the Quiet Place movie that was earlier this year, too.
Oh, that's a new one.
She did a fantastic job in that one, too.
Did you guys know she was dating Joshua Jackson from The Mighty Ducks?
Shut the front door.
I mean, they're no longer dating. As of 3 days ago, she's confirmed with everyone that she's single following the split with Joshua Jackson.
What the heck? Man.
Yeah. Oh, Lupita Nyong'o confirms she's single following Joshua Jackson's split, but happily in love with her cat.
Good.
So,
For a minute when you said Joshua Jackson, I was like, Dawson's Creek Joshua Jackson?
Same one.
Okay.
Oh, that guy?
From Mighty Ducks.
Pacey.
I don't.
Charlie from the Mighty Ducks, little boy.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God.
He's the one that does the...
The Triple D.
I more remember him as Peter from Fringe.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I think that's a Lupita, we love you. You are driving the story entirely.
Other notable people that actually kind of took us by surprise. Pedro Pascal as Fink, the fox.
He tried to make himself not sound like himself, but he sounded like himself, which was funny.
And he still did a phenomenal job in this one. Like, In the book, I don't know if it's notated that, like, Fink was a girl, but the woman kind of made it sound very, like, almost like the cat from Infinity Train.
Mm, okay, who's cat?
Yes, but the way that, like, she enunciates her words and she speaks, okay, it's very like a 50s kind of mysterious woman kind of thing, like 40s 50s kind of vibe.
It's a little Lauren Bacall, but not all the way.
And in this one, like, Fink was played by Pedro Pascal, which he played the epitome of, like, the sidekick character to the main character, and giving in all ways that he can, and also gave us one of the more emotional moments of the film, to be quite honest. And it was very, very beautifully done. Was there anybody you guys wanted to highlight?
Do you want to go first, Spencer?
You already look like you're about to pounce on your mic. So
no, do you want to go?
No, you can go first.
You go first.
You're going first.
No, I'm not.
Amy.
Those goes.
I don't do that.
Yes, you do. I want to take yours, Spence. Go.
You're not going to.
It is true, because she would take yours.
On accident.
That's all. No, it wouldn't be an accident. You'd then be like, I like this person. And then at the end, all these other things.
She goes, well, yep. I also like these people, but I'm not going to say them because.
And that's why you give Spencer space. Give Spencer the space.
I think I will just pick someone at random, and I will go with Stephanie Hsu.
She was
not in here for very long, but, like, you can just tell she was instantly having fun as Vantra, the evil robot, here to collect the wild robot back. Barely in it for, like, what, 10, maybe 20 minutes?
Yeah.
But, like...
But it is for the climax of the film. I mean, let's be honest. And she did, like, pull in everything that made her amazing from Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great seeing that again. That kind of craziness, you know, in Stephanie Hsu. So that was a good pick.
That was a really good pick. Too.
Yeah, yes, she was definitely, she is another one who, much like the Pizza Nuango, was able to take the initial, like, more recent gen of Siri and then make that evolution go in that short span of time without, like, overly changing everything drastically. It was great. It was a great performance. So.
Also, within, like, the first two notes, you could just tell, oh, she's cray-cray.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And mind you, we'll get into the animation style, but the animation style in this film made all of those instances seem still slightly realistic, but also also cartoonish in that animation style. So that was great as well. Ames.
So this one is kind of just a collective because I can't name each of them. I can't name each of them. But the children that were all the little animals this, that's the reason I have to say it. Which, mind you, I was watching the credits and they all have actual credits, which is great. So I'm sorry, all of you children that were critters. But, like, there were so many great one-liners. The possum children that were all dying. And it's like, I'm dying. Meningitis takes a long time. Like, between that, the bunny rabbit that yells, they're here to kill us. Like, there is such a great space of letting the kids be themselves in such an organic space that you're just like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. And I really wanted to, like, talk about them in relation to the film as a whole, because it's one of those kind of unexpected spots. Like, it again, and they're peppered through the entire thing. So it wasn't just like one performance. I can't be just like, it was possum number three, the possum that came back after he got snatched. Like, they just did a great job. And it's such a wonderful thing to see that they have an acting credit that they can take forward with them going wherever else.
Oh, wow. There was 12 of them.
Go 12 kids.
So, I mean, if we're looking at it. Alexandra Beggy, Tiago Martinez, Becca Last, Madeline Turpin, Kaylee Rain, Isabel Turpin, Beckett Blomberg, Damon Fung, and King Moore.
Yay!
And they're babies. Like,
oh, they're littles.
They're littles. So this is what they look like in their most recent headshot, but when they were recording those lines,
they were little.
So, yeah, those scenes were really great. And I think the authenticity of having actual kids play these baby versions, like, and only DreamWorks could take scenes and situations that are very, very no-go for Disney and make them still work. Like, and that's been the nature of, like, the battle between DreamWorks and Disney for ages. But, like, speaking of the baby raccoons, like that scene, or the baby possums, where that scene where the mom is talking about her kids and then one gets taken. And
she's like, I have seven kids. And you hear, the screaming and something trying to eat it. And she goes, well, I have six. And it's so, and again, that's also Catherine O'Hare. We have
fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then that's just like the nonchalant, like, whatever. It happens. And you're just like, oh my God.
Well, and the nature of, like, the rotation, if you will, in so many unspoken terms, the rotation of her children, and she's like, so-and-so, and she goes, I'm not so-and-so. That was your last batch of kids or something. And it's like, and she's like, meh, oh well. But that's like a big no-go, like, direction for Disney. Disney will kill your parents, but they won't take away children. They won't you know, and this blatantly made that point right up front, like, yeah, I got six kids. And then for them to do the follow-up, like, hey, mom, I'm okay. It's coming out all disheveled. And she goes, oh, great. And it's like, okay.
Which was actually really fun, too, because Catherine O'Hara didn't really sound like super Catherine O'Hara, which was another, like, it was in that space that she was just providing parental support. And if anybody's going to provide parental support to somebody, it needs to be Kevin's mom.
Yeah. I have to say, the addition of Bill Nighy as Longneck in this film, as the old seasoned goose who leads the flock, his inclusion in this film was very welcomed. Like, it was like a... It was the element that only a seasoned older British man could bring to an ensemble. And his inclusion in this just made it so great. And yeah, like I loved his portion of it. I loved his narrative that worked with Bright Bill. Yeah, it worked out really well. So
yeah. This cast is so small, literally you could just be like them.
Because quite literally. Because like, I mean, if we're just gonna name off the top of our heads, you know, Matt Berry, who played Paddler, the beaver.
The crotchety beaver.
If you don't know who Matt Berry is, Matt Berry got his start in the IT,
crowd.
The IT crowd, and then also has got main success with What We Do in the Shadows. And then Thunderbolt was played by Ving Rhames. Thunderbolt the Hawk, played by Ving Rhames.
Which was neat. That's another neat section that I'd love to talk about for sequences.
Which, mind you, Thunderbolt is not part of the original book. So that was
a
cool.
It didn't matter. He's good.
No. I'm saying though, the
listening
inclusion,
to her talk, I was like, yes.
The inclusion of him in that in the story was really great. And then of course, Thorn the Bear being played by Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill
was great. So,
Forgot Kit Connor.
And then Kit Connor, who played Bright Bill as well. Which, if we're gonna be honest, let's also mention Boone Storm, who played Baby Bright Bill. So, and Baby Bright Bill is just as great as grown Bright Bill. Let's be honest.
Boop, boop, boop.
So let's talk about the story. The story was and is a very unique tale of kind of the existence of parents and caretakers and things of that sort in a construct that most people aren't really used to seeing it in, in the hands of something that's usually not meant to be a parent, which is the robot. But you know, the base understanding that the robot goes through and the awareness of like the logical awareness of like, this doesn't make sense. Why is this happening? And a seasoned parent has to tell him like, hey, that's just the way things are. You're just going to have to deal with it. Mm. It definitely carries this whole sense. Like the movie itself, I feel had a little bit more heart to the centralized message of the story than the book. Which is good because, mind you, the book had great bones. It was a great place to start. But I remember telling Amy after we left the theater, I'm like, there was a couple things that were different that either were in the book that wasn't in the movie or was in the movie that wasn't in the book. But the main bones of it, the main theme of it, it was very similar. But there were certain elements in the book that really seemed like, yo, I don't know if we could do that in the movie, but this is going to be really interesting.
For instance.
So one of the scenes that we get a scene where Roz is walking. So she and Bright Bill are walking in the middle of the night trying to find their home, their, you know, shelter. And they end up getting ambushed by two bears. These bears happen to be the son and daughter of the mama bear that is supposed to be played by Mark Hamill because the bear is supposed to be a female bear. Mm-hmm. But they're the son and daughter who are just jerks. They just want to be jerks. And they quite literally start fighting with Roz because everybody on the island thinks Roz is a monster. So they start fighting with her and they ultimately have a scene where one of the bears grabs Roz by the foot and just rips it off in a gnarly way. And that's kind of where I know in the movie we have the scene where her foot gets stuck and so she no longer has a foot. In this one, the reason why she doesn't have a foot in the book is because the bear took the foot. And mind you, the mama bear comes out and literally has to like yell at her kids to get them to stop because Roz is working her way into kind of being friends with some of the older animals. And so these two bears just didn't get it. And then one of them almost falls off a cliff and Roz saves them. And then, you know, the mama bear's like, they will never bother you again, Roz. And Roz is like, okay, I thank you, blah, 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 whatever. So that's in that one. That's one of them. That we also get another scene where there is the discussion. So in the movie, and mind you, we talked spoiler alert. So in the movie, we see the flight to the south for the gooses.
Mm-hmm. The geese.
The geese, the gooses. And you don't know what happens until Bright Bill comes back. And when Bright Bill comes back and everyone else, Bright Bill is the one who is leading the group. And he begins to tell Roz and the other animals about what happened and how they landed. They hit a storm and they landed on this patch of is a farm. They landed on a farm and they get threatened, but ultimately it's an empty threat, by an old cat who said, if I had been younger, I would have eaten you by now. And the cat just tells him, you know, just stay out of sight, because the people who run this place, they don't like things taken from them. So they're eating, they're enjoying whatever. And there's this type of robot that's called a Rico unit. And
they're the ones with the pew-pew guns that we see.
And the Rico unit sees them and starts alerting, and they go over and Long Neck doesn't see one of them, and he gets a shotgun blast to the face. Quite literally.
Hmm. So really, that was in the movie.
I mean, we're talking bullets. That's just like lasers, like bzz, bzz, like
they kill the same.
But they talk about it in a little bit more detail in the book. And then on top of that, like, we get the scene at the end where in the movie it's different. I'm not gonna say how, but in the book, it's almost like a manhunt fugitive kind of thing. Like, the Rico units are literally all chasing after them, and they are killing animals left and right. And it's down to this one last Rico unit, and the animals have learned how to fire shotguns. And so
I see Spencer's wheels turning, going, this is not a problem for me. I mean,
because it happened in the movie too with the lasers.
They didn't shoot the laser. So mind you, again, the difference in weaponry, if you're going to put a laser gun, I mean, they had a laser gun in Toy Story.
Okay. So I mean, for some reason, there's a difference between a gun that shoots bullets and a gun that shoots lasers.
When was the last time you've seen an animated film with a gun in it?
The Wild Robot.
An actual gun.
That's a laser gun.
It's a laser gun.
That's a gun.
That's not a gun.
Yes, it is.
Can you go buy one at the store?
No, because that's why you can buy regular guns.
Yeah, you can.
You can't go to a freaking Target.
We can go to Walmart right down the street and go buy a gun.
Oh, that's because it's Walmart. It's ghetto.
There's one in every part of the city.
You'd have to build a laser gun. Just a whole bunch of lasers.
Exactly. Exactly. Listen. Listen, resin printer terrorist. We're not talking about building weapons here, but we're saying accessible.
I'm just
saying. It's different in the sort of, like, because we don't get a lot of the grotesqueness or even the graphicness of getting shot in the face. Or,
oh, wait, the books were graphic about that?
Yeah, they mention it and they talk about it.
Shotgun blast to the face.
I thought I saw that these were for ages 7 to 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have very different ideas of what's appropriate for 7 to 10-year-olds.
It also depends on what era these came out. So this was the 90s?
No, 2016.
Shut the fuck up.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if they had done it more according to, like, to the book, this would be a very watership down film. Like, because even the scene where they go out and they're looking for other animals who are still alive to take them back to their shelter where it's warm, they go into very detail about how many animals they find that are frozen to death in the snow. They go into detail. And in this one, it's like Fink finds when he goes and he gets sad, and Roz puts a hand on his shoulder and, like, we will keep going. And, like, they, you know, obviously.
No,
keep
she was a little gentler than that.
Well, I don't even think she says anything. I don't remember
He's
what she says.
He's not Lupita Nyong'o, so he
I
can't
know. Know.
Right? Like, oh, I'm not.
I'm judging.
That's the best impression you can.
Yeah, I mean, I'll do everything else, but the moment I do that, I'm like, that's wrong. But I think outside of, like, a lot of those different elements, like, I feel like the film still carries the heart of what this book, and even more so on another level as well, what the book is trying to get across, which is, you know, caring for people doesn't cost you anything, and being part of a community is something that is valued and important, because it's not about what your function is. It's about the people who love you around, who are around you that love you, you know? And I think that's an important takeaway from both the book and the film. But talking about the film specifically, were there any parts of it that you kind of resonated with, Spencer, that, you know, you really want to highlight?
I mean, like, just general highlights.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to talk about the art stuff.
I was just going to say, that's kind of where I was leading.
Because, man, I wanted to say something, so I had to do a lot of research just to make sure I was correct. So I watched Disney's Wish.
Oh, you did watch it?
I did watch it.
Oh, God. Lord.
Man, I kind of want to say we should talk about that movie, too, because of that movie.
I'll watch it just for you so we can do this off-air conversation.
Oh, my gosh.
If it's an extra credit, Eddie's going to yell at us.
Okay, so the art in this movie kind of is outclassing what Disney has been doing recently.
Yeah, yeah.
So DreamWorks and Sony have been outclassing Disney for a few years now.
I feel like I haven't noticed because, like, most of their mainline properties have not really called my attention to them. So, like, I haven't really noticed that they've been outclassed like that.
Into the Spider-Verse?
Yeah, for a while, like...
But for Disney specific, also that's Disney Animation versus Pixar.
Yes, you have to draw that distinction there.
Which is the distinction?
Pixar, you are Pixar, and then you are Disney. And
they're so jealous about that.
So
it's
salty.
Crazy.
It is so ridiculous. Salty. Like, I really do hope, and I know I've said this for years. I really do hope that Pixar gets out from under the thumb of Disney and just does their own thing.
I really hope to win the lottery, and that way I can buy them and make them like an employee, like back to the employees, because then they'll all take care of each other.
So, coming in back to the art style portion of it, for the last couple of years, Disney has had Wish, Strange World, Encanto, Raya the Last Dragon, and then Frozen 2. I think out of that bunch, like Encanto, I think would probably be the one I thought of that looks like pretty good. Mm-hmm. But like, I feel like they're not as adventurous as they used to be. Like, especially back in the Renaissance days,
yep,
where like they were out here to try things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like they had gorgeous animation, and then like they're like, let's try some 3D stuff with like Mulan or whatever. And we're definitely getting that from like DreamWorks and Sony Animation Studio, but like Disney just seems terrified to like take a big swing. And then when they do take a swing at something, it will blow up in their face because like they're not listening to the right people, it seems like.
No, 100% true.
So like I kind of really like how this movie looks because like I feel like DreamWorks has actually got it and they're like, hey, we know how to push animation forward with computer technology and like give people something that looks different. Because this movie looks great, but it also looks just different from their last movie, The Last Wish, Puss in Boots.
Mm,
like they both look gorgeous, but they're both different in style.
Yeah.
And I kind of just love that about that.
Yeah, there's a sense of almost like a painted background at certain points in this film, whereas with like Puss in Boots, it was more of a digital design for certain elements in the film throughout it, and it almost seemed like almost more modernistic art style versus like this one has almost like a what's his name, Kurt Kincaid.
Thomas Kincaid,
kind of like that vibe with some of the backgrounds and in the distance, and because you have like the trees and the forest and the butterflies and things like that, like you got to have that element in there, but then you have to incorporate the modern aesthetic of a robot being a part of it, you know. So it definitely has a very distinct art style and is one that honestly makes the film all the much more enjoyable to watch.
Mm-hmm. Because there are certain scenes in this movie that are just like, you could make that like a painting.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
oh yeah.
Especially initially, like when Ross is like with all the butterflies that just fly off that tree. I was like, this is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's something that kind of does need to be brought up is that Chris Sanders, his own personal art style, especially in relation to Lilo and Stitch, they were all watercolor backwards. And that's how he, as an animator and an artist, kind of sees it, and he diverts on purpose because it's what makes him happy. And it fills in such a really organic place in this movie where the backgrounds are not impeding anything. It just gives it additional texture and life, especially in relation to Roz and Enough herself, who is so, with for no better way to say it, artificial.
Yeah. Well, and you also take into effect, like, both of these films, their background are in very, like, very foresty type places, very green. You know, there's a sense of nature that needs to be recognized. And you look at Lilo and Stitch and everything that's in the background. Yeah, it was all watercolors, but there were vivid colors. There were very much attention to the trees and to the different colors of the palm trees and the plants. And even the coloring, like on the wood paneling of the house or things like that, or the beach or the ocean. They were all elements that were intended to have a very natural, artistic look, but at the same time, have it clash with the modernistic take of the characters that are forefront and center, i.e. Stitch, who is an alien, and in this one, Roz, who is a robot. Mm. You know, so I think the idea of being mindful and cognizant of both of those juxtapositions is very prevalent in Chris Sanders' work. So.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to add? What about you, Ames?
For me, if I'm just doing, I mean, Spencer hit the nail on the head with the art style. It is breathtaking. You could easily remove all of the vocals, which you don't want to, but you could literally turn this into one of those like hour and a half long, like YouTube things with just the soundtrack playing over it. And you would be so happy. Hmm. Really, when it comes down to it, this movie had so many themes, and it wasn't just about purpose, and it wasn't just about being a parent, and it wasn't just about community. It was also a space for self, and they are all lined up in, like, it was successive gut punches, like, for theming. And as a parent, yes, I was like, oh my gosh, she's a parent now and she doesn't know what to do. And it's, I have a kid, like, trying to figure out what to do, looking to the community to help provide that support. But also in that space of identifying and going, my purpose is complete. What do I do now? Or I don't have a purpose. And then I'm supposed to have a purpose. This is what I've been designed for, but I don't know what to do and nobody's helping me. And it was hitting all of these spaces and these tones and just this, it almost felt like it should be too much and it wasn't. Hmm. Like when we first meet Roz, she's like, there's a customer, I'm supposed to help somebody, somebody ordered me, and she's going about it all the wrong way. And we're watching her progress, like progress through that. And then when she gets to the point where she finds a customer, quote unquote, and she's like, okay, I'm all done. And she meets Pinktail, and Pinktail tells her, no, these are the directives that you have. And raising, you know, the gosling is your directive. And then she has a purpose. And then once that purpose is grown, which happens very rapidly, mm-hmm. you start seeing how her as an AI, but also as a person, as a being or as a soul, starts transitioning through all of those spaces to understand. And then when Brightbill's gone, instead of just, okay, I'm all done, it becomes a, this is my home. These are my friends. These are my, you know, this is my community. This is you have sacrifice and perseverance mm-hmm. and like all of these things that keep just waterfalling.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel forced. It never feels fake or saccharine. Like, there is no artificialness to the way the story progresses, and it's absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think one of my weird favorite, if I can point out just one specific moment, that it not even accidentally made me kind of go, and it felt like it should be fake, and it wasn't, was when Pedro Pascal as Fink tells the gosling a story, and he's trying to explain to Roz about, you know, tell him a story, help him go to sleep. And she's like, she gives him something really terrible. And he's like, whoa. And then Fink comes in and Pedro completely changes his exactly how he's like been giving this entire character beforehand, where he like kicks the duckling into the ocean, goes swim. It's, you know, once upon a time, there was a little gosling that was on this island and was all alone. And so he looked up at the stars and he wished for a mommy. And he tells this story about Roz, who doesn't understand yet the part that she means as a parent to this gosling. And he does it with such compassion and a sense of loss, but a sense of hope. And when he finishes up and the gosling goes to sleep, you're just like, oh gosh, like I don't want to root for anybody. But it's absolutely beautiful, in both in art style, which the art style changes again, and it goes to like a little kid with crayons, and then the vocal performance again. And I'm like, dang it, y'all. Like, you're not supposed to be doing this. Listen, Pixar. I mean, listen, DreamWorks.
Yeah, see,
like,
that's actually listen. Right there is a huge compliment.
Exactly. And I need to watch it again, and it's going to mess me up again. And I really do not care. Like,
I've already seen it twice.
See, you're ahead of me already. But like in the best ways, yeah. Like I've always been able to find in Pixar. And this is the one thing. Disney has not been able to do that to me. Like, oh my gosh. I don't even recall the last time I actively cried during a Disney movie.
I'm going to pull up a list.
And that's the thing, like, even, and I can bring this up because, yes, I did watch Frozen 2. There's a song in there that I know we pluck out that song, and it was called Do the Next Right Thing. And that's the one thing I remember. I don't remember the rest of the entire movie. I just remember literally there's a moment where this song comes on, and it's like, Anna, whatever her name is, she's stuck somewhere, and literally the song is about doing the next right thing, just putting one foot in front of the other. And I was like, that song gets me. I can pull that song out of that movie, and the movie doesn't matter. But I do not remember an Encanto, again, the music with that animation for that one sequence. But before that, or after that, Pixar wins. Pixar gets me every time. Like,
yeah, no, they're really quite good at it.
They're just like, hey, like, I mean, come on. Like the Iron Giant. I don't care how many times I've seen the Iron Giant. I will still start crying at the end of that dang thing. Like, I don't know.
Like, I think the last movie that truly moved me in a way that was unique to not only the storytelling, but the way it was delivered, I think it was probably Luca.
Which is Pixar.
Yeah.
Is that Pixar?
Yeah.
It is Pixar.
Yeah, that's
the
thing.
It's very hard.
And that's literally the problem that, like, even Moana, which I cried over, the grandma made me cry. But that's the grandma. I don't think of where I could look at the story as a whole and go, this entire story has moved me organically. And if this is the only one of its kind, I'm okay with that. Like, what else you got? We've got Encanto, we got Moana.
No, I pulled up the whole list, and I'm already in the 90s, and I'm like,
I mean, I remember being utterly terrified in the original Beauty and the Beast, and then like Enchanted, but I never started crying. But like, if the hallmark of great animation is to make you feel, then what has Disney been doing for the last couple of years?
I mean,
because I don't have a problem with feeling when it comes to the House of Miyazaki.
Yeah, but like, I don't know, like looking back over like all of Disney's film, Disney Animations Studios filmography, their movies are very different.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, because I'm doing the same and I'm like, yeah, these are just distinctively different. Like, if I'm looking at anything, probably the last film that actually made an attempt on some kind of subtext of a story that had like connecting points was probably Ralph Breaks the Internet, but that was 2018.
Oh. See, I was thinking about the original one.
Yeah, the from original 2012.
Because that scene at the end where he's like just flying into the ground.
He's quoting the bad guy creed.
Yeah, that I was like, okay, that kind of gets me.
Yeah. Man, okay. See, but that one didn't technically even need a second.
No. Nope. Technically. But, you know, the internet exists.
Exactly.
Yes. And do you know what else exists? Me.
Okay.
Put her in the third one.
Right. It's.
Ooh, The Fox and the Hound. That's the one that made me feel. There we go.
Yeah, but that's from like the 70s.
81.
That's not great. Yeah. If you have to go back 40 years.
The. literally going.
Are you saying you did not cry during Mufasa's death scene in The Lion King?
I don't remember crying. I think I shut it out.
okay, whatever.
That literally, like, when you brought that up, I was like, oh yeah. But even now, I'm like thinking about it because I watched it in the movie theaters. I don't remember crying over Mufasa dying.
She was like, finally.
Right, apparently. Oh,
that's scary.
Talk about daddy troubles over here. She's
oh,
like,
we've
yeah,
already established that in theater or in the therapy, not in theater.
Okay.
Sorry, do you have a highlight? I'm like,
I honestly feel like the effort to do the Pixar formula, if you will, which is not so much in like how they create their stories, but how they present complex themes to a level that even a child could understand. That's something that Pixar has like literally rewritten and rewritten and revised and rewritten the book on. They've been able to create opportunities to discuss death, to discuss lineage, family trauma, personal emotions, adolescence. Like they've been able to create tools, if you will, to assist in parents and adults and even teachers in how to approach certain conversations that would have been taboo, you know, in anyone else in any other situation to bring up to a child. And then you got DreamWorks, who incorporated with Puss in Boots' Last Wish, the element of like anxiety and panic attacks and what that looks like, and to create moments of understanding. Like even before we got Riley and her panic attack, we got Puss in the middle of that forest with Perito, and scene alone. Like, if you want a great example of that, that's a great example of like what it looks like when somebody is struggling and having a panic attack in that moment. Like, that's a great example as well. And that came well before Riley. Just saying. Just want to put it out there.
But some of us saw it after Riley.
That's true. Yeah.
That's okay. But also, Perito, if we want to talk about trauma. Woo!
Yeah.
Oh, that was a great performance too. Man.
But seeing as DreamWorks is also becoming a contender in the emotional support of, you know, our today's youth, alongside Pixar, I feel like I have to appreciate the fact that giving an opportunity to create a story where in certain families, you know, the dad that's in the family may not be the dad that birthed the child or that was a part of that child's, you know, conception, or the mom that's currently in the situation might not be the mom that is that child's mom that lives in the home, or neither parent is the original parent of the child. And you create that conversation of like, well, how do you approach a conversation about a child who just got adopted and is now in my classroom or is now in my home, and I want them to know that I am here for them and I will take care of them. However, I'm also still learning too. And I feel like this is a great tool for this. This is an awesome opportunity to share a story where a child can see this and say, hey, I'm like Bright Bill. And vice versa at the same time. A parent, an adult, a guardian can look, or even a teacher can look at this film and say, hey, I'm Roz in this film. And you create that connection where conversations can be had. It's the bridging point for a child and an adult or a guardian to have, to where they can say, we are like this and they made it, so we can make it too. You know, and I again, much like what Pixar has done for the last 2-3 decades, you know, these guys, DreamWorks, the powers that be, are making this an opportunity for us to carry that and to create those conversations in a healthy way that can be presented and easily replicated, because it's already in a format that can be seen easily by children and by adults. I have to give credit not only to Chris Sanders, but even to Peter Brown for creating the story, and as well like the whole ensemble cast who created this film to be as engaging as it was. It takes a village, and this is one of those instances where, yeah, you have great source material, but you also had a great, you know, script team and a great writing team. You had a great director and you had great performers. This had all the markings of success already earmarked for it before it released. So, I appreciate, from being a previous educator, I appreciate the opportunity to add another, you know, quiver in, you know, another arrow in your quiver to use when working with children who not everybody has the American model family. Not everybody has two parents. Not everybody has one parent. Not everybody has, you know, a healthy family, a place where they can live and grow and thrive. Some people, they're going to have that restart moment where they're not going to be in that same home, or life changes and they may have a restart moment where they no longer have this one particular parent, and maybe later down the road, another one will walk in the door. Like, these are conversations that we don't think about now, but as an educator, as someone who's worked with children, like these conversations happen. They do happen. They do exist. And how do you approach that without the tools, you know? And that's just from the teacher side. I can only imagine from the parent side, like, how do you approach that without the tools or the means to be able to sit a child down and say, I know you're struggling, but it's going to be okay, you know?
Which you actually do see a moment in this, which I applauded as a parent that's done this, when after Roz finds out, you know, we need to get Bright Bill up in the sky, he needs to do it. You know, Long Neck said, hey, he needs to train every single day. He needs to be able to do everything. And Roz is like, I can only do so much. And when she brings in Thunderbolt, that's exactly what a good parent does, which is, my limitations are impeding me from giving you everything you need. I can provide you all the tools, I can provide you all the books, but if you are looking for somebody that knows, we bring in somebody that knows. You give that space, which is a part of also just being a human, but understanding that community is what will always continue to shape not only us, but the ones that we take care of. And bringing in Thunderbolt, and Thunderbolt, who was literally like, look, listen, I'm at a disadvantage anyway, but you are, he goes, everyone will see you as a disadvantage. And according to everything, you should have not survived. You should not be here, but you are. And let's prove them wrong. It was just one of those things that I'm like, that's a great parent. Without even trying. She doesn't know it. She's a great parent.
Yeah. And again, this story is chock full of moments where either as a parent or as an adult, you are looking at it and you're like, yeah, I've had that moment. I've had that kind of situation with a child, or I've had that kind of situation with another adult, or like, and you recognize the you know, desperation in Roz's voice at some times, and you understand, you know, Bright Bill's point of view at certain times. And this movie belongs in the same tier as some of the best Pixar films that we've had to date.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why I say, like, Inside Out 2 was great, and it absolutely, you know, changed another level of how we perceive, you know, inside emotions and things like that. However, this movie, I still haven't processed it fully, but this movie is up there in terms of whether or not it, I know it's definitely tied, but I don't know if it pulls forward or if Inside Out 2 pulls forward, but this movie is up there. And I got to give it the credit.
That's a really hard thing to like figure out for at least me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that about wraps up here. So let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether or not the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
Well, if you couldn't tell, this movie really does pass for us.
What?
I think it's going to be I'm going to preemptively say it's passing for the entire table, but especially for me, it passes. there is nothing short of having an opportunity to go to a theater and experience a work of art that is a pure outpouring of not only the artists, but everyone involved. This film is not only a labor of love, I have a feeling that it will be a cult classic, much like Lilo and Stitch. From the art to the music, which takes you by surprise, to the performers, this film gives space and recognizes everyone who is on a journey to not only better understand themselves, but to love themselves. And at the end of the day, remember and retain who they are. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. That's easy.
Spencer.
Yeah, this movie passes. Movie's phenomenal. Like, hands down. Like, it's one of the best animated movies I've seen this year. Barring Inside Out 2, which is...
It's right there.
They're in their weird orbit around each other. But yeah, no, fantastic story. Like, when I get out of theater and I immediately put on your soundtrack for your movie, you've done something extremely well. Mm-hmm. So... just all around the board, like, I don't even know how they could have improved on it. Like when you're at this point, you've done a phenomenal job, and I can only give you a 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
Of course, as Amy stated, this film gets a pass for me. The story itself is beautiful, and it's wonderful, and it creates this open-endedness that you hope later down the road they're going to revisit. If not, they're going to create something... if they don't continue to revisit this film, they've either way left it off on a great point. And honestly, I don't see how at this point Disney's animation studio is going to catch up, to be quite frank. In terms of the film itself, this is a beautifully told story. This is a story that creates so much conversation, as you've obviously witnessed here. It creates so much conversation, so much beautiful imagery, and honestly, amazing life lessons that can be taken to whichever and however direction you choose. I definitely see this movie becoming not only a cult classic, as Amy stated, but also a learning tool and an opportunity to teach adults how to create those conversations that, much like we talked about with Soul, or other like Coco and or other films from Pixar, how to approach conversations that are difficult to have without, you know, the means to express it. Like it's hard. And with movies nowadays, them becoming a form of therapy for certain people to create that bridge, that relationship. This is, again, one of those types of tools that we're going to be putting into our hat to share with those that need to understand the elements and the base truths that this film produces. So obviously a 5 out of 5 for me. This film is phenomenal. And I urge you, I implore you, I just push you to go and see this film as soon as you can, because yeah, this is a great film.
And so, if not, it'll be on streaming shortly. And please watch it.
Yeah, it'll probably be on Peacock.
Universal's Peacock, right?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, animation, topics about the industry and whatnot. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers, and give us a follow or subscribe and listen in. Let us know what you think. Did you check out The Wild Robot? Did you like it? How much did you cry? Let's be honest. Let us know in the comment section down below, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Also, if you think we did a good job in this review, give us a 5-star review, because we've earned it.
We have.
It made Spencer cry. Give him 5.
It made Spencer cry. Please give him 5. There you go. That's going to be the new slogan for the
episode.
You can also check us out on socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. Almost pulled a Spencer. there you can check out all of our great hijinks and other content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene on Instagram. Where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane Unseen on Instagram and Instagram only. And every time you say on Instagram, it kind of throws me off. So I'm
it's
like,
on Instagram.
I know, but you're Instagramming before I can Instagram, where I said, I'm Instagram's my Instagram spiel.
Instagram.
Instagram.
Nah.
We also have Blue Sky at the Filmosphers podcast on Blue Sky. You can check us out there as well. This is a great film, and this is a great opportunity to talk about this movie. And honestly, if you get a chance, go see this film. Talk about it with your friends. Tell everybody else about it, because it's just a phenomenal movie. So
that 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, you know, kind of says it all.
So, but again, that wraps up another great episode. So, from all of us here at the Filmosphers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.